Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners. Thank you guys so much for listening, and thank you for your positive reviews and for just being you. And with that being said, I'd love to do another episode with your stories. So I'm calling for any and all interesting stories. Cults in your hometown, cults you may have accidentally joined, family or pet heroes, family secrets, and just so you know, all names can remain anonymous with family stories or any stories, so don't let that scare you away. I'd love to hear stories of lucky breaks, near misses. You get it. I've gotten super excited to receive your stories you sent in before. They're so enjoyable and interesting to read, so the floodgates are wide open on topics. So please send your stories to 7deadlysinnerspodcast@gmail.com. I'm looking forward to reading and sharing them. Okay, now for the story. Many Hollywood stories are all things fascinating, inspiring, but oftentimes very tragic. And perhaps some of the most tragic are the ones where the movie star started out as a child star and whose life was really never their own. They grew up fast. They worked like an adult when their peers were out riding bikes and catching fireflies. And that could not be more true than our case today. This is the tragic and mysterious death of Natalie Wood. Her star-studded career that had gorgeous highs but very painful lows. You see, Natalie Wood, in my opinion, was a victim to the times, the system, even her own mother. Men took advantage of her, left and right. Sure, many cared about the fragile beauty, ingenue, but it wasn't without a predatory sense that Natalie was theirs. And Natalie, it seems, only wanted to be loved, adored, and respected. She wasn't always the shrinking violet, too. She was portrayed as that sometimes, but she was smart, she was funny, she was sassy, but she was also very, very vulnerable.
I don't know whether to ask you this or not, but I'm going to. If you don't want to answer it, okay.
Go ahead.
But you and Bob Wagner, your husband, you had a difficult time and split up. You were both young, successful, beautiful ingenues. What do you think the pressures were in the first place that caused the problems in the first place? Do you know, have you ever thought about them?
Oh, yes, but I mean, you know, it's hard to come up with an easy answer to that. Many people seem to think that, you know, it's Hollywood, or that's the kind of conclusion that's easy to jump to, but I don't think it was that. I think probably we
sources for this episode include the work of Suzanne Finstead, who wrote Natalie's biography and conducted interviews with everyone she could in Natalie's life. Her book, Natalie Wood, The Complete Documentary, as well as some articles in LA Meg she wrote and Vanity Fair, a 48 Hours documentary, Death in Dark Water, and a documentary, Natalie Wood, What Remains Behind on HBO. So who was Natalie Wood? Born Natasha Zakharenko to Russian immigrant parents, she had one sister born Svetlana Zakharenko. Both sisters would eventually be given American-sounding names by studio execs, Natalie Wood and Lana Wood. Both became stars. Both became stars. And Lana became Natalie's advocate after her death. Lana, as a side note, also became a Bond girl and appeared as Plenty O'Toole in Diamonds Are Forever. And it's not surprising that both became Hollywood actresses, because when they landed in San Francisco after leaving Russia, their mother, who was the ultimate stage mom, and with whom both sisters shared extremely codependent relationships with, she exclaimed that her girls were going to be stars. Specifically Natalie, though. While both beautiful, the mom, for whatever reason, favored little Natalie. So whether they wanted to or not, the little girls were going to work. Natalie was a beautiful girl next door. I hate that term, though, because she was more than that. She had the je ne sais quoi that makes it in Hollywood. Big, beautiful eyes and sweet features. Sure, she was the girl next door, but she had the talent to back it up. And she did so from a young age. Miracle on 34th Street is one of the most iconic holiday movies, even one of the most iconic movies of all time. One in which Natalie made her debut as the adorable little girl that didn't believe in Santa Claus. But Natalie's childhood was anything but charming. Allegedly, her father was an alcoholic, and her mother's domineering pursuit of her children's fame was stifling. It affected Natalie the rest of her life and colored how she would view herself in intimate relationships. And her mom didn't help with this. Natalie did become a huge star. As a teenager, she was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress for her performance in Rebel Without a Cause, followed by a role in John Ford's The Searchers. Wood starred in the musical films West Side Story and Gypsy, and received nominations for an Academy Award for Best Actress for her performances in Splinter in the Grass and Love with the Proper Stranger. But with all of this success came a lot of heartbreak. Her mom was so controlling that when Natalie was allegedly raped by a Hollywood actor, who is rumored to be someone very big, but I'm not going to say their name, you can Google it if you would like, she was at the Chateau de Marmont testing for a role. But Natalie came out crying, according to her sister Lana's biography or book about her sister and her own life. And Natalie came out crying from the Chateau Marmont. And Natalie's mom told her just to stay quiet about it, that she needed to focus on her career. Don't let anything screw it up. Then when Natalie was assaulted again, coerced, I guess is a better word, allegedly by the producer, or the director, sorry, of Rebel Without a Cause, saying that she needed to prove to him that she could play a bad girl. I wouldn't say it was necessarily assault. It was predatory behavior on a 16-year-old girl. And then prior to that, her mom apparently arranged a sexual liaison with Frank Sinatra when Natalie was just 15. And the relationship with Sinatra and Natalie lasted off and on through various times of her life, even when she was dating and living with other men. Frank Sinatra would pick her up, take her out, and he did seem to really care about her, but in kind of a controlling way, like most men in her life. And he was sort of involved in the sort of cover-up regarding her death. I'm going to keep that vague because you'll hear at the end how it all shakes out. All the while, just remember her mom saying, "You're going to be a star. Keep things to yourself, Natalie, and you will be a star." In 1956, Natalie is 18, and studio execs set her up with 26-year-old Robert Wagner, or as they called him, RJ, as a way to get publicity for Robert Wagner's up-and-coming acting career. But they ended up falling madly in love. During their first marriage and throughout Natalie's adult years, and likely teen years or even earlier, Natalie was still struggling with her mental health, though. Natalie had a lot of phobias and paranoia and insecurity. She had a hard time sleeping. She'd often take pills to help her feel better. And she couldn't figure out why she was so unhappy, despite being in love, having an amazing career. So she starts leaning on a psychiatrist that she talks to almost every day, or at least for a period of time on her lunch breaks on set. He becomes a sort of crutch of sorts. Every day, she would speak to him on her lunch break. But I think it's actually very responsible of her. If she was struggling that much, at least she sought professional help. Then in 1957, she married Robert Wagner. They divorced in 1961. The tabloids wrote that the breakup was caused by an affair between Natalie and her co-star Warren Beatty, when in fact, when Suzanne Finstead was privy to a memoir Natalie had been penning on her own before her death, she read this. So, Suzanne says, "The memoir validated all I had written and all that I had intuited. Natalie touched upon the, quote, demons from her past and how as a child she had, quote, always done as she was told. She said she had, quote, no real identity, that she was terrified of flying. Her romantic illusion from childhood of RJ is a magical prince charming, her reliance on her analyst, that she was scared to death of water. In her own handwriting, Natalie confirmed that her divorce had nothing to do with Beatty. Quote, there was gossip and speculation that Warren was in some way responsible for the end of the marriage, she wrote. It is totally untrue. She even confirmed the rift I disclosed that they had during the Splendor in the Grass, writing between takes, Warren and I went our separate ways. Natalie had allowed the press to run the story in order to protect RJ and perhaps her own public shame. And Warren and Natalie had been very close on the set of Splendor in the Grass, a movie Natalie would be nominated for an Academy Award for. So it was the perfect breeding ground for that rumor to fly and to cover up what had actually allegedly happened. In reality, allegedly, according to interviews conducted by Suzanne Finstead, Natalie walked in on Wagner in a very sexually compromising position. Again, this is all alleged. But Suzanne Finstead was able to corroborate it with various interviews from Natalie's friends and family. I'm not going to say what it was, but you can Google it if you would like. Natalie, always the protector, though, would never say this publicly. She was so distraught over it, though, she attempted to die by suicide. It destroyed her. The people close to her said she was absolutely destroyed. So after the divorce, she does end up dating Warren Beatty and several other men before meeting and eventually marrying Richard Gregson, a producer-director type, and they have a baby named Natasha together. Natasha also went on to become an actress and also recently made a documentary about her mother. Wegner also goes on to marry after he and Natalie's first divorce. He marries a woman named Marion Marshall, and they have a baby together named Katie. At one point, Natalie does do an interview, clearing up the rumor that her and Beatty were having an affair, stating, "She wanted to set the record straight about why she and RJ divorced. She said, I have suffered in silence from gossip about my walking away from my marriage to go with Warren. But Warren had nothing to do with it. We began our relationship after, not before, my marriage ended." Natalie continued to protect RJ, alluding to not revealing the sexual betrayal that shattered her. That's in Susan Finstead's words. But then Natalie says, quote, "It's too painful for me to recall in print the incident that led to the final breakup. It was more than a final straw. It was really crushing the fragile web of romantic fantasies with sledgehammer force." Wood's relationship with Beatty also tortured Robert Wagner. In his book, he writes, "Then Warren came into the picture. That summer, when I read about them as the hot young couple around town, I wanted to kill that son of a bitch. Life magazine was calling Beatty the most exciting American male in movies. My last four or five pictures had been flops. I was hanging around outside his house with a gun, hoping he would walk out. I not only wanted to kill him, I was prepared to kill him. Everything was coming to an end. My marriage, my career, the life I had built. I remember thinking that if I couldn't kill Beatty, maybe I should just kill myself. It was either flip out or flip the page. I chose the latter." Natalie and Wegner remarry in 1972, just 3 months after her divorce from Gregson and his from his wife. And they have a daughter named Courtney. So the blended family consists of Natasha, Katie, and Courtney. Her sister Lana asks Natalie why she got back together with Wegner, because Lana is frankly shocked by this. And Natalie says, "The devil you know is better than the devil you don't." They remarry on a yacht and honeymoon in Catalina Island, an island about 48 miles southeast of Los Angeles, only accessible by boat, helicopter, or private plane. And from this point on, boating, or yachting, better put, would become a regular pastime of theirs. Odd, because Natalie was petrified of dark water. You see, her mom had taken her to a psychic or a gypsy, it's been said both ways, and that gypsy said that this little girl will grow up to be a great beauty, but she should be leery of dark water. Something like that, or I can't remember if she said she may die in dark water. Regardless, a very eerie premonition. So, from being a little girl to adulthood, Natalie was terrified of dark water. But she got into yachting with RJ, and maybe she was trying to overcome her fear, or maybe it was to please RJ.
Sounds like a script. Very lucky. Stephen Krantz was on our show a couple weeks ago. You know, his wife Judith wrote Scruples.
Oh, yeah.
And he's written a book about Hollywood. He says that it's such a pit that you fall into, that it's just not a good life, that the values are missing and all of that. Do you find that to be true, living
well,
there?
Well, I think it can be like that, but I think everybody has to make their own way, you know? And I think you can do your own thing. And go your own way. You don't have to rush to all the openings or do whatever, you know, those things are that rattle your cage.
Yeah.
And I think, we were able to spend a lot of time together and with our kids, and we have a boat. So that's a good thing for us, because we like to do things, you know, with our children.
Is it tough for you to protect your privacy?
Well, it's easy with the boat, because you can get on the boat and within minutes, you know, you're away, and it's peaceful.
Is Bob as delightful as I think he is? He has a twinkle in his eye.
He's terrific.
Is he? Is he a good father?
Oh, he's a terrific boss.
How about, Lizzie, if you could leave your kids with one thing, one thought from what you learned in life, what would you instill in them? What would it be?
Oh, God, one thing. It's hard.
I'll take two or three.
Honesty and a sense of humor.
Yeah, those two are important. How about growing up in Hollywood, though? Is that tough? Is it hard to protect them from all those bad things?
Well, I think growing up today anywhere is tougher than it ever has been. I think, we're faced with problems that we never had before. Ecologically, we're threatened. The atmosphere is polluted. And children at a very tender age are exposed through television mm-hmm. to things that, when I was growing up, we just didn't know about. And so it's a difficult time. I don't know if Hollywood itself is that damaging.
You think maybe it's the family unit that's more important?
I think so.
Well, you are a delightful, warm lady, and I wish you lots of luck. And thanks for the interview,
Thank you,
Natalie.
Regardless, it was a regular thing for them. They bought a yacht called the Challenger and renamed it Splendor after her movie Splendor in the Grass. It's said that renaming a boat is bad luck, but Natalie shirked that off. So they purchased a 60-foot yacht with 5 staterooms and hire a boat captain named Dennis Davern, who ends up becoming a very close friend of theirs. Their marriage was getting rocky once again at this time. Natalie was 43 and roles were declining, and RJ's career was picking up. He landed the leading role in the 80s sitcom Heart to Heart. And there were rumors of flirtations on set between Wagner and his co-star. Very typical Hollywood stories. Natalie also worries Wagner drinks too much, and maybe that influences her to drink too much. The relationship is starting to become toxic again. So it's 1981. Like I said, Natalie is 43, Wagner is 50. They've been married the second time for 9 years now. Despite Natalie feeling that the roles in Hollywood are declining for her, she lands a role as a lead in a movie opposite recent Oscar winner Christopher Walken. The movie is called Brainstorm, and Natalie and Walken form a close friendship while on set. So it's Thanksgiving weekend 1981. Natalie and Wagner invite a few friends to go on their yacht to Catalina to have a good time. Apparently, all of the friends dropped out besides Natalie's current co-star, Christopher Walken. RJ had formerly visited Natalie on the set of Brainstorm and felt like they were flirting too much and suspected that there could be an affair. He writes in his memoir later, it was at the very least an emotional affair, something along those lines. And his suspicions were not helped by the fact that once upon the boat, Natalie and Christopher Walken began openly flirting, according to Captain Dennis Davern, and he said he didn't like Walken immediately because of that. However, Walken seemed to not want to do anything with interfering in a marriage or their fights. And Natalie and him could have just been close friends. Natalie needed a lot of support, it seemed, and would lean on anyone who made her feel safe, it seems. But to possibly add to Wagner's jealousy of Walken, Walken was the it guy in Hollywood at this point. He was coming off of an Oscar win from Deer Hunter, and he was starring in a movie called Brainstorm with Natalie Wood. So, it's the captain, Dennis Davern, Christopher Walken, Natalie Wood, and Robert Wagner. Sounds like a hell of an uncomfortable weekend. They set sail around noon on Friday, the day after Thanksgiving 1981. The conditions are not great, which is why the other friends who were supposed to come canceled last minute. Walken had no fear, though, and I can't find if this was actually said or if when I was listening to the Stuff You Should Know podcast, also about this case, they do a great job, check it out. But I can't tell if they were just making a joke because the host says it, and frankly, very well in Christopher Walken's voice, or if Christopher Walken actually said this and it's documented somewhere that I can't find. But everyone else who planned to go on the trip dropped out because of the weather, and Christopher Walken maybe said, "It takes more than a few raindrops to frighten me." I'm not going to try to do his accent, but I'm going to say it again. "It takes more than a few raindrops to frighten me." It feels like a very Christopher Walken thing to say. So they're forced to anchor about a quarter mile away from the island in the town of Avalon. So in order to get to town, they have to take a dinghy. When they arrive at Catalina, there isn't a spot available right at the island's shore to park their yacht. So they are forced to anchor about a quarter mile away from the island in the town of Avalon, or a quarter mile from the town of Avalon. So in order to get to town, they have to take a dinghy. Friday night, Walken, Wagner, and Wood all go into town to have dinner at the restaurant on the island. The captain, Dennis, stays back at the boat. They drink and eat at the restaurant and head back to the yacht. Natalie, with her fear of dark water, and really, who wouldn't be afraid of it when the seas are starting to become rough? RJ wants to move the boat because of the rough seas, but Natalie is begging him to go stay at a hotel because she's scared. But RJ sends her and Dennis, the captain, to watch over Natalie to get a hotel on the island. Nothing romantic happens, but Natalie does confess, through tears, that she's thinking of divorcing RJ. Remember, they and Dennis had become very close friends with their captain. Natalie was planning to get a helicopter back to LA the next day, but RJ must have smoothed things over enough that Natalie returns to the Splendor. That Saturday, they begin drinking early and head to a more secluded part of the island, Isthmus. Natalie and Walken end up taking the dinghy alone to the restaurant in Isthmus, very hard to say, a restaurant called Doug's Harbor Reef. Staff later remember seeing Walken and Natalie laughing, getting drunk, having a great time. And then RJ eventually shows up and gets very jealous about how much fun they are having. Here's the thing, though. I'm a tad confused because some sources say they were all initially together, and some say, and it's depicted in the documentary, the HBO one, that RJ shows up later. So I'm speculating here, but I'm guessing Natalie and Walken went into town earlier on the dinghy, and then they found a space to dock maybe on the yacht, and RJ got off and joined them later? Or did they have two dinghies? Because they would have had to have taken a dinghy back to the boat if, again, maybe there's two. This part's very confusing to me because it's been depicted, a few different ways, but here's the version, at least, that I visually saw in the HBO documentary. It's Natalie and Christopher Walken hamming it up, having a great time. RJ shows up, Robert Wagner, and joins the party. So it seems once RJ showed up and the day of drinking had, you know, kind of wore on, the staff were noticing more alarming heavy drinking and more alarming behaviors, not just like the fun and jokes that like Natalie and Christopher Walken were having. And allegedly, according to the staff, Natalie was showing some uncharacteristic volatile behavior. But the whole group was so drunk that when they departed the restaurant's manager, Don Whiting, called the harbor master and said to keep an eye out for their safety. He was that worried about them. He was that worried they wouldn't get on the dinghy and get to the boat safely without someone just keeping an eye on them. And then things escalated from there. Around 10 p.m., they head back to the yacht. They continue drinking. According to Dennis, the captain, and I believe he was also in on the party as well. But again, according to Dennis, Natalie and Christopher Walken are openly flirting. And in Dennis's recounting of the events, he says that Wagner got so upset, he grabbed a bottle of wine and smashed it on the table and says, "Jesus Christ, what are you trying to do, fuck my wife?" Walken then goes to bed, uncomfortable and not wanting to get involved, but kept hearing them fight loudly later, later, and later. And so does Dennis. He said it's one of the worst fights he's ever heard them have. He hears things being thrown, explosive yelling, and the next thing he hears is the ropes of the dinghy moving around and then silence. At 11:30 p.m., Wagner finds Dennis on the yacht bridge and tells him Natalie is missing and the dinghy is gone. He then tells him not to call authorities and not to turn on the searchlight, which Dennis wanted to do according to him, and they continue drinking for about 2 more hours. Then around 1:30 a.m., Dennis and Wegner finally call the island and say Natalie is missing and to look out for her. Then finally around 3:30 a.m., the Coast Guard is called and they begin a formal search. November 29th, around 8 a.m. 1981, the body of Natalie Wood is found floating in the water only a few miles from Isthmus, where they had had dinner earlier that evening. She was only 43 years old. She was wearing flannel pajamas, cozy socks, and a red down jacket. America and the world were devastated. She was the girl next door, America's sweetheart, who they watched grow up from the little girl on Miracle on 34th Street to the accomplished Oscar-nominated actress. They watched the ups and downs of her love life, and a beautiful American treasure died in one of the most mysterious and heartbreaking of circumstances. Sometimes it's hard to imagine, if it was just an accident, that a life that shines so bright could be gone in such a meaningless way. Perhaps that's why people wanted Wegner to be the cause. That would give a finger to point to. And honestly, who knows? Robert Wegner and Christopher Walken took a helicopter back to Los Angeles and left the captain, Dennis, to identify Natalie's body. Natalie's case was officially reopened in November of 2011, and detectives assigned to the case tracked down witnesses, one being Christopher Walken. Christopher Walken largely remained silent after Natalie's death, but in recent years has spoken to investigators. Wood's death was initially ruled an accident, but her death certificate was amended in 2012 to change her cause of death from drowning to drowning and other undetermined factors. Lana Wood, Natalie's sister, told the Post in 2021 that she has always believed Wegner was responsible for Wood's death. She said, quote, "I don't believe it was premeditated, but that doesn't mean I don't think he did it. Of course he did." According to Suzanne Finstead's Vanity Fair article, quote, "A source had information that Christopher Walken said he heard a fight between RJ and Natalie, and that he told a friend not long after Natalie drowned that Wegner had pushed her." Lana once asked Hernandez and Kevin Lowe, the two lead investigators, about Walken's new statement. Ralph said the only way Chris had talked to them is if it was never disclosed. After they spoke with him, they told me they had enough to charge RJ. So, end quote. Other witnesses who detectives spoke to were Vidal Herrera, who took photos of Natalie's body for the coroner's office. He said he saw major head wounds to Natalie's head and gave a sworn statement regarding this to Detective Ralph Hernandez. Detective Hernandez agrees the head wounds are troubling. Wounds that could be synonymous with being in a violent fight and possibly pushed or tossed into the water. But there were a few other Walken quotes that he made publicly about the incident. Ones that weren't from a source, but directly from him, that conflict with what that source had said. Walken spoke in a 1997 interview with Playboy, theorizing about what had happened to Natalie that night and how she ended up in the water. He said, "Anybody there saw the logistics of the boat, the night, where we were, that it was raining, and would know exactly what happened. You hear about things happening to people, they slip in the bathtub, fall down the stairs, step off the curb in London because they think that cars come the other way, and they die. You feel you want to die making an effort at something. You don't want to die in some unnecessary way." He keeps going and says, "What happened that night, only she knows, because she was alone. She had gone to bed before us, and her room was at the back. A dinghy was bouncing against the side of the boat, and I think she went out to move it. There was a ski ramp that was partially in the water. It was slippery. I had walked on it myself. She had told me she couldn't swim. In fact, they had to cut a swimming scene from Brainstorm," that's the movie they were in together at the time. "She was probably half asleep, and she was wearing a coat." He continues saying, "The people who are convinced that there was something more to it than what came out in the investigation will never be satisfied with the truth, because the truth is, there is nothing more to it. It was an accident." I mean, it's such a mystery, and I don't know that anyone will ever have a definitive answer about what happened to Natalie Wood. It should be noted that Robert Wagner was cleared in 2022 of any wrongdoing in Natalie's death. Today, he is 94 years old. Natalie Wood was buried in Westwood Village Memorial Park Cemetery in Los Angeles. Representatives of international media, photographers, and members of the public tried to attend her funeral, but all were required to remain outside the cemetery walls. Among the celebrities that were allowed to attend were Frank Sinatra, Elizabeth Taylor, Fred Astaire, Rock Hudson, David Niven, Gregory Peck, Gene Kelly, Elia Kazan, and Laurence Olivier. Olivier flew in from London in order to attend the service. And that is the tragic and mysterious death of Natalie Wood. Thank you guys so much for listening. If you're enjoying the show, please leave a 5-star rating and positive review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Thank you so much. Love you. Bye.